Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. Join us as we explore his longer adventure stories in their chronological publishing order. We'll talk about what makes them so enduring, their historical context, and how well they hold up today. So get out your reprint and get ready to enjoy our remarks.
Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who loves duck comics and loves talking about Barks Christmas stories. I've got a returning guest who is back appropriately enough. We get to talk about our second round with a Barks drawn, but Bob Gregory written Christmas story today. So I think this is going to be great. It's an excellent pairing. It's an excellent pairing of stories to focus on. So welcome back to Alban Leloup. Welcome, Alban.
Hello, everyone. Once again, happy to be here for the, well, I was going to say third time, but it's actually the second when it comes to Barks Remarks. Glad all the same.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for joining me. I think I qualified this like the first time around by saying this, you know, I was bringing you on for a pretty slight story when we got to cover Christmas in Duckburg, which was, I have to say, a lot of fun for not being a Barks written story. This one is kind of in the same vein. It is maybe a little bit even less serious than the Christmas Cha-Cha. It almost struck me as a little bit sitcom-like in its tone, Alban.
Well, no, I'm not sure what you mean. Why did you say sitcom-like?
Well, I think that's a great question to maybe come back to as we go into this story, and I can maybe point out a few things that evoked that for me. But before we do, I want to make sure that I give you a proper introduction, remind people about your credentials if they didn't hear our last Christmas story focused episode, which, you know, given that we're again going to be talking about Carl Barks and Bob Gregory, I keep almost saying Bob Foster, who was like an editor with Disney Comics around this time. Given that we're going to be talking about Barks and Bob Gregory, you really should check that one out. But my understanding is that you've got a couple of different roles. You are an at-large editor. You are a freelance editor for the French titles for some range of mostly Picsou, right?
Right. Correct.
But also Le Journal de Mickey. And remind us, where are you based, as if people can't guess from my hopefully not too terrible French accent?
Well, I am Belgian, but I've been living in the south of France for about 10 years by now. So you could say I represent, well, I'm trying to represent the best of both worlds.
Right. And I understand that you're soon going to be diving kind of into the Dutch side of comics as well. You mentioned to me that you get to do a little bit of translation coming up soon.
Yes, I've only started, 2 weeks ago. So I just translated my about 10 first one-pagers. Normally they should keep coming, and I'm so happy to be a part of this, because, you know, when you're a translator, when you get to name characters in your language, right, which is part of the creative process, you know, translating is writing a second time, if you get my drift.
I like that. I'm going to remember that. Translating is writing a second time. I think that's probably how the best translators are looking at it, right? And then I know that you also, you can be found online as one of the principal people involved, the French fanzine Picsou Soir.
Yes, I am currently serving you. You could say I'm being the acting editor-in-chief, because we've had a little bout of power vacuum recently, and we decided that we should be managing the whole thing together as a team, and there shouldn't be a single unmoving editor-in-chief. We are going to take turns.
Oh, excellent. Well, yeah, by all means, people should check out Picsou Soir And let's do it, Alban. Let's get into talking about this story. I haven't looked at all of Bark's Christmas stories like laid out, but he has quite a few, you know, ones that are even this length, right? What I call adventure length stories. That's why this very slight tale, this very lightweight story, the reason it's getting its own episode of Bark's Remarks is because it meets my somewhat arbitrary requirements of it is longer than 10 pages, thus adventure length, and it primarily features either Donald or Scrooge, and it at least has art by Carl Barks. So that's it. It makes the grade. We might not dwell on this one as long as we would one of his classic adventure stories, though, or go into as much depth. But this one came out in the Western title, Christmas Parade. It was number 26, but I'm not sure about the numbering there. I don't think that there were actually 26 Christmas parades. I think that may be a numbering convention.
I think, to be perfectly frank, the numbering of these Dell issues is a complete mystery to me. I don't even know how the people, how the Index people managed to find any logic in all that.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, this one is from October of 1959. This is going to be one of our very last publications from the 50s. It's a 16-pager, a little bit on the shorter side. And I do like to check in and see how widely reprinted these stories are. This one's been in 18 different countries from 110 publications overall, of which there were 6 American reprintings, which is definitely on the lower side for a Bark's Christmas story. It kind of is just a testament to how how lightweight this one is.
I see there were no less than 15 French printings. Can you imagine that?
Wow. Yeah, that's
a lot.
That is a lot. Although, does some of that account for, did they serialize it? I bet they must have serialized it.
Well, let me see. No, I don't.
Some of these Le Journal de Mickey, they seem like they're alternate printings. Maybe they have like an alternate cover for a few of those, like Le Journal de Mickey 20.
You're right. These must be alternate covers, right?
Still,
not quite 15, but let's say 12.
I always do like to pander to international listeners before we dive into the story itself. Didn't look ahead.
Claro que sí.
Claro que sí. Excellent. All right. So let's go ahead and have me do the French, because that's funny to me.
Please do.
What would you like to do?
Well, I'm going to be a complete coward and go with German.
There you go. Yeah, and I mean, as I look through, the vast majority of these do have the word cha-cha-cha in them, or cha-cha, except for German, interestingly. All right, so let's see. I'm going to look for the French one that kind of seems to recur the most, and it looks like it's qui sait danser le cha-cha-cha.
Si?
Is that?
Yeah.
And that seems to mean who is dancing the cha cha cha? Who dances the cha cha cha?
Who knows how to dance the cha cha cha?
Okay. All right, so who knows how to dance the cha-cha-cha? And how about German?
Well, it seems that story only has had one title in German, which is Ein poetische Weihnachtsfest, which seems to mean a poetic Christmas, a poetic Christmas.
Yeah, isn't that weird that it went with that subplot?
True. Well, that subplot in itself is pretty weird, but we'll be coming to that.
And let's be coming to it pretty quick, because I don't want to belabor this one. We let's launch into the Christmas cha-cha. I guess the only thing to kind of reiterate is just a reminder at who Bob Gregory is, right? I mentioned that Barks didn't write this. Bob Gregory, we discussed him a bit last time. He was a Western, a writer for Western Publishing. He wrote quite a few of these stories. I did note that there was a quote from Barks on this one, in which, in a letter to Michael Barrier in 1968, he said that the Christmas Cha-Cha was not my story. I did the drawings and did a great deal of rewriting and polishing on the dialogue of the script, which was sent to me by the office. And then it said, it further said in on Series AM on the Carl Barks Library page that the writer is unknown. But Index seems pretty definitive that this is, in fact, Bob Gregory. So it may have been that it was unknown at the time. But Albon, that's interesting to me because apparently Barks did at least give this some level of polish.
So we could play the game where we are trying to separate the Gregorian influence from the choices of Barks. That's
right.
What you want to do.
We could do that all day long. I think we kind of have to default to assuming that most of it was written by Gregory. And that makes me feel kind of charitable towards this story. So, Albon, since we last recorded, I put out an episode on another Barks story that was not written by him.
Right.
Which was called Jungle Hijinks and is officially author unknown, although I mentioned that I strongly suspect that it's Vic Lockman. Covering that story may have made me feel very charitable towards this one because I just found it so repellently awful from a storytelling point of view that I'm like, oh, great. It's another Bob Gregory story. What a nice change of pace that is. So, well, so like...
Lockmanian tales have a particular identity. Well, in this case, that's not a question of identity. The themes themselves, of course, that are dissonant to our values, I guess.
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. I regardless, I think this is, you know, before, like, not to jump ahead, but I think that this one is going to end up being a perfectly fine, serviceable little Christmas story. That's kind of, I might feel just a little bit more positively inclined towards it, having recently covered one where things went so poorly from a writing perspective.
Well, it's certainly wholesome.
Exactly. So let's get into it. The Christmas Cha-Cha starts out in kind of in the vein of the, like, 10-page stories, right? We've got a very, like, domestic scene with the nephews having a very cute little war, playing war as kids do. And Barks, you know, I guess Gregory signals for us in the narrator box that it's the last days before Christmas and they are hectic ones at Donald's house. And we hear through the nephews complaining that their uncle has been wearing out the floor practicing the cha-cha. And we see that Donald is practicing this dance in order to participate and hopefully win his gift for Daisy at the Duckburg Pavilion Christmas dance, in which a silver bowl is the first prize. Very snazzy, as the nephews point out. What do you think, Albon? What do you think of seeing Donald striking the cha-cha pose?
Well, first things first, I must confess I have no idea how you're supposed to dance cha-cha, so I can't speak for the accuracy of his poses. But what I can say is that it's a treat to look to see Donald, which is at the same time very enthusiastic and relaxed. You know, there are not that many things in his life that put him in such a state of, just look at the second and fourth panel here on the first page. He looks so chill about the whole thing.
He really does. And he looks like he's having a genuine good time. He looks like he's getting quite good at the cha-cha. I guess we should take a moment to ask ourselves, what is the cha-cha? Do you know much about it? It's obviously a dance move, but do you know what's like significant about it?
I know it's of Cuban origin.
Yes.
Of course. I don't know much more than that about it.
Yeah, I'm not much of a dancer, and I'm no authority on dance, although I do know that Cuban music really like bats above its, it hits above its weight, right? They've had a lot of amazing music and dance come out of Cuba. So, you know, I of course resorted to Wikipedia as I do. And I think the interesting thing, couple of things, right? Sometimes it is called cha-cha-cha, which would explain why we saw that in some of those translations. But to me, the interesting thing is that this was developed pretty contemporaneous to this story. It was
in the 50s.
Yeah, exactly. So this is like very current. This is a very almost trendy Disney comic story.
Can you imagine what the modern day equivalent of that would be? What kind of dance competition would Donald participate if Barks was still alive and producing comics today?
Exactly. It's a good point, Alban, because I have to admit that every once in a while, when I read a more recent Disney comic and it makes a reference to YouTube or something like that, I can't help but cringe a little bit. To me, it feels a little bit like it's not what I like my Disney comics to be. And yet I'm someone who read the Disney comics like 20 and 30 years after they were produced. So to me, some of the stuff that was contemporary, that it feels more classic, like it's just frozen in amber, even though it really was of its time.
We do tend to forget that the universe shown in Barks's stories used to evolve with the times. We've seen toward the end of his career, we've seen him draw Gladstone as a beatnik.
Right.
And there was a thing also about the wig craze, you know?
Right. Of course, the weird thing is at that point, he was like at retirement age.
Oh, he was completely out of touch.
Right. You have an out of touch man, reasonably out of touch man, trying to keep up with kind of contemporary stuff. But it's interesting, right? To me, it's neat that he's written this. Very briefly, it says here, cha-cha-cha is danced to authentic Cuban music, although in ballroom competitions is often danced to Latin pop or rock. Danced to the music of the same name introduced by the Cuban composer and violinist Enrique Jorin in the early 1950s, and it was developed from the danzón mambo. So the interesting thing to me is that it's contemporary.
In fact, unlike, say, for example, The Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck by Don Rosa, these are intentional period pieces. Barks's stories are unintentional period pieces.
Right.
You see.
And of course, Gregory has developed the premise here. This certainly doesn't seem like the kind of thing Barks would have chosen, although here and there. So, Alban, yes. the sequence continues here with him talking about his plans for, you know, giving this gift as a gift to Daisy, who's going to be his partner in the competition. There's some joking references to how surprised she'll be if he demonstrates himself a good dancer. And he has a backup, too, if he is not able to win this. What's his backup, Alban?
Well, if he can't win the competition, he is going to buy her a present with his commission money from selling Christmas cards door to door.
Yeah. So this is like our subplot. I don't know. It almost feels like they're both subplots somehow. neither of them is the main plot.
I know. Yes.
This, I think, is a big part of why this feels so sitcom-y. It's like the way that it's going to come back to characters, the way that it focuses. This is like a sitcom trope, right? Someone has to like make a lot of money before the big event. someone has to learn how to do something really well for the big competition.
Right.
These are pretty hackneyed tropes that certainly happen in stories of all media. They just feel like they have that sitcom beat.
If it were a child instead of a grown man or grown duck, he'd probably start washing cars or setting up a lemonade stand in front of his yard, probably.
Right. Or trying to save the community center or something. So Alban, I like this next sequence a lot. You know, we know that Donald is going to start selling Christmas cards the next morning. The shtick of them is that they are poetic. They're poetry supposedly written by famous poets. Although they're very basic. Anyone could, Bob Gregory could have written these, clearly.
It does sound a lot like your run-of-the-mill novelty cards you can get pretty much everywhere, which is part of the reason I don't really understand this subplot at all. There are so many strange details about it. Maybe you'll be able to explain to me. Again, I'm being your basic European here and wondering, is that an American thing? What's so convenient about this? Because really, if I get this right, the system is this. The customers buy those cards. They are sent to them by the company, and then they have to send them themselves to other people. What's all this? Why is it good? Why is it convenient? Why would anyone want to buy that?
Yeah, exactly. It's billed as very convenient, which the only reason I can think of is that it's story logic, right? Donald needs to get that letter out for the story to make sense. But I think the only thing I can point out from an American perspective is that it is the case in the 50s that this kind of like door-to-door salesman stuff was really enforced. I don't know if that carries over to Europe, but it was a major. You really could, I think, make a much better living doing that kind of thing than you could today.
Oh, you see it a lot. Traveling sales. How many times do you see Donald trying to sell something? You know, I'm thinking of another story. I think the title is Flower Follies, where he's trying to sell Scrooge's new baking powder.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You see a lot of the salesmen. It makes a really good shtick here. And I do really like this sequence. I like that he decides to this feels very in character. Some of what Gregory writes does not necessarily feel in character to me, like the ducks all being eager about the cha-cha does not, but Donald being really enthusiastic about the Ajax method does. And so I like how he walks out to against the backdrop of a milk truck that says Dawn Milk and says, I guess most folks are still pretty relaxed at 6:30 a.m. and so this is pretty funny. He's going to basically sell some milk. He's going to sell some cards to some lady who is basically totally almost still unconscious. And
she hasn't had her morning coffee yet.
Right. Do you want to read his sales pitch, the rhyming sales pitches?
I'll try. I just wanted to point out, even though I'm sure most of the audience knows that by heart, that the company that sells these cards, Ajax is like the go-to name in Disney productions for any big corporation. It's like the Walt Disney equivalent of Acme, the Looney Tunes.
Right. Yes. Thank you. That is a good thing that I didn't want to gloss over. Yeah. So tell us his pitch.
Good morning, ma'am. How do you do? Your favorite Christmas card salesman is calling on you. This year, all cards are swell. You know it. For each was composed by a famous poet.
That's very funny, though, the part where he's having her sign it when she's fallen back asleep.
It does look like some real life door-to-door salesman methods.
Right. I'm not going to go over every one of his sales here. they're cute. They range from being cute to funny. But eventually he's going to check in on Uncle Scrooge, thinking there must be something in the Ajax sales pitch to appeal to Uncle Scrooge.
Yeah, I must say he is exceptionally optimistic in this venture. I'm not sure why, but nothing seems to deter him, you know?
Yeah, I'm noticing that in these like Bob Gregory depictions of Scrooge, he, you know, the one you and I did last time, he was very interested in like his appearance, and he was uncharacteristically generous, not as miserly quite as usual, or at least more willing to entertain things like buying gifts. It should also be mentioned that there are going to be constant references to Donald reassuring people that the cards will be here on time. You know, I won't call every one of those out, but it's going to become a little bit almost overbearing how many times he mentions.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yeah, right.
see where I'm getting, see where I'm getting at with it.
Exactly. So, you know, Scrooge does initially react how you would expect until Donald points out that you can order them embossed in with your name embossed in gold. And that's how he entices Scrooge to order. This is another bit that I really like, Albon. Tell us about Scrooge's order in terms of quantity and quality.
Once he's been lured with the promise of gold, Scrooge decides to buy one single card for 2 cents a word. Donald kind of expects him to take 50 or maybe 100. Like I said, he's incredibly optimistic in this story for some reason. But Scrooge just wants the one, which he won't even send. He's going to post it on the bulletin board of the Billionaires Club so everyone can see him, and he doesn't need to buy a stamp to send it. So, of course, he's making sure he's making a huge profit of those few cents.
Right. I like this. Even if the Scrooge stuff is just a little bit out of character in this story, this moment feels very Scrooge. What does his card say, by the way?
It says, "Dear friend Noel," the end. there's a funny detail I want to point out in this scene. You know, you've got this feeling that Barks maybe didn't have this at this point. He didn't really know where Scrooge was supposed to live, because in this story, he clearly lives not in a mansion, not in his bin. He lives in a rather nondescript house. And for some reason, he has a portrait, a kind of family portrait of the Billionaires Club on his wall.
Right.
Go figure why.
it's pretty weird all around, right? I guess it makes sense that he doesn't like necessarily live at the money bin, although that's usually where we see people calling on him. So it is weird that it feels just like kind of a suburban house that anyone could walk up to and ring the bell on. Let's see the next brief sequence. As Donald leaves, he references, you know, he references Scrooge's stuck-up friends, and this kind of causes Scrooge to like reflect in surprise. Oh, is that what people think of us? And we see some funny graffiti that reads "Fooey on Pinchpenny Scrooge and his tightwad billionaire buddies, a caricature snowman." It seems very gentle compared to some of the criticism that are levied on billionaires these days.
That's true. It does seem very gentle, and Scrooge's reaction is kind of funny in an unintentional way, because surely he knows he isn't seen as a man of the people,
right? And this was something that Gregory kind of focused on in that last Christmas story too. Scrooge was very put off by being shown up at the big Christmas, whereas you imagine that Barks written Scrooge does not care and is delighted to be seen as standoffish.
Sure, he'd say, "Bah." Humbug.
This next sequence is going to introduce Daisy herself to the story. And I've been very like kind of Gregory, but I'll give him a little bit of criticism here. So Bob Gregory, is the other thing that he's known for is writing a lot of the Daisy Duck diary stories. And there's definitely an element of kind of a very old-fashioned vibe to interactions between men and women here. So we get Donald, you know, calling on her in his salesman capacity, and he makes another sale. But just before he's able to leave, she's going to rope him into one of those like big, only a big, strong man can handle this task. Yeah, she's going to manipulate him a little bit. It's gentle, but it drips with sexism, right? Like by our standards, it wouldn't fly here.
I think I already had the occasion to say it, although I don't remember in what context it might have happened. But the fact is, most writers of that time just didn't know what to do with Daisy and female characters in general. So yeah, yes. it's always about being somehow conniving or having something to do with charity or some boring club or boring activity the guy is obligated to do and tries to escape. It's a recurring theme, and well, it really isn't the strongest aspect of those 1950s stories.
Right. Yeah, you said it very well. This is fairly typical, although it's worth noting that she does literally bat her eyes at him. So, I mean, it's very hackneyed. It's very cliched. Every time Donald is going to wander through the town at this point in the story, he's going to encounter one of these ladies, and they're almost always ladies that he has sold Christmas cards to.
Make sure my cards will be in time for Christmas, Donald. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, I don't know whether I should be critical of Gregory's writing for like really hammering the reader with this, or if part of me is like, yeah, this is good writing, you know, because like he is making sure we don't forget. But there might be one or two incidences of this too many.
Well, we are grown men. We need to remember this was meant for much younger readers.
Right. So. And that's one of the things where I'm like, Barks probably would have respected his young readers enough if he had written it on his own. But you know, that is conjecture. So at this point in the story, this is where things are going to go wrong. Donald and the nephews are both going to make kind of a shared mistake here. Donald's mistake is going to be getting home and asking the kids to rush out and mail the envelope of orders to the Ajax card company. So that's on him for trusting kids with something so important. And the nephews, obviously the mistake that they're going to make is not doing so, although it's not going to be revealed for several pages. But, and the reason that they don't is because they're so distracted with their task of coming up with decorations for the downtown store windows. There's a lot of elements going on here, Albon. What do you think? Are we juggling too many balls?
The question is why? Why is it down to the junior woodchucks to decorate the downtown store windows? I mean, I don't get that. This is not charity work. This is not your typical Boy Scout activity. So the store owners are counting on free labor from the local Boy Scouts to deck the halls.
Right. And why is it on our three woodchucks? Why is it not the whole troop?
Right. Why is that? Because it's convenient for the story. Right. But it still seems a little distracting because you can't help but wonder. I get that you need some elements in place to get the story moving. But this might not be, this, I think, raises more questions than it answers.
So. Yeah, I agree. And this is also where it kind of feels a little bit more sitcomish to me, because we've got, like, a lot of sitcoms will have the A plot and the B plot and the C plot. And that feels like what we've got going here. Okay, so we mentioned, you know, that maybe we could try and suss out the little bits of writing that Barks punched up. And obviously it's conjecture, but Alban, this next sequence at the billionaire's banquet, I'm going to go out on a limb and make a guess that Barks punched up the dishes that the billionaires were eating, because they sound, to me, they're very funny and they sound like something Barks would have written. He says that they're all going around the table and talking about how delicious their dishes were. One of them says that marinated terrapin was superb. Another, I liked the spiced ibis wings. And another, what zesty breast of peafowl. So they're basically eating either uncommon or highly rare animals here.
Pass the flamingo casserole.
Yes. Yes.
Yes, you're right. It does sound like Barks, something like Barks would write.
Right. And although officially I should be generous and acknowledge that this could be all Gregory.
You know, I do love this particular sequence for an entirely different reason. It's because you hardly ever see characters that are not waterfowl or dog noses. And in this case, you have a bear, you have a bull, and I like to see that kind of a diversity in the character designs. And I'm not quite sure why Barks did it here and not so much everywhere else, you know?
Yeah, and I think we might have seen that in the previous Bob Gregory one as well. So part of me wonders if maybe Gregory is actually designating these characters, or maybe it's just Barks is like, well, I get to have a little bit of fun with this one because I don't have to think about the script. So maybe that's where he put his energies into, because, you know, I got to talk with Patrick Block. It's always fun to have on. And he was telling me that in his conversations with Barks himself, he talked about how Barks actually, like, spent almost as much time really perfecting his dialogue as he did with the art, which is pretty atypical for writer artists. So maybe he really got to put a little more energy into it than usual. I don't know, but you're right. It's kind of fun seeing these more unusual. I was recently thinking about that. I was like, I wonder what is the most common. It feels like dog nose characters must be the most common, even though ducks are like the main characters. There are just so many background dog noses.
Mm-hmm,
and pigs, and I feel like pigs are pretty close behind.
I should note that obviously, most of the billionaires are pigs. Well, I mean, in Duckburg.
Yes.
That's all I'm going to say.
That's all you're going to say. You're just noting.
So if any billionaire is listening to this podcast, please don't feel offended. I'm strictly speaking about Duckburg.
Right. And if any billionaire is listening to this podcast, please feel free to hit up the Patreon. We don't actually have a Patreon, but if a billionaire wants to do anything with it, I will make one just for them. So basically, the point of the billionaire's banquet is for Scrooge to get roped into providing the prize for Duck. It's also nonsensical, right? That, like, they're already advertising what the prize is, Duckburg. Why would they not have secured it? But, you know, somehow Scrooge is able to be roped into providing that silver bowl because he's very concerned about the billionaire's appearances. So they nominate him to provide the prize. And then very briskly, we're going to transition to Donald and the nephews. They've got this big task that Daisy has roped Donald into and that they volunteered to help him with of hoisting the big Christmas tree atop the big pavilion. It's cute. You know, there's a funny reference to the tree being called the General Sherman. Did that register for you? I wasn't sure if that's more of an American reference.
Oh, it's totally an American and references absent from the French version. Obviously, it wouldn't have meant anything. In the French edition, they say something like, you never told me that tree of yours was part sequoia, you see?
Oh, okay. So yeah, it is pretty well known that in Sequoia National Park, that there is like a tree that is nicknamed the General Sherman. It's one of those just enormous sequoias. It's not the biggest in the world, but I think it's pretty close. We get another of those ladies asking for reassurance. I do like the bit a lot on the next second page of this sequence album, where another lady is asking Donald's nephews about the Christmas cards, and the nephew that is closest to her lets go of the rope that they're using to guide the tree and uses his hands to explain. See, lady, it's like this. That's a funny bit of slapstick that results in the tree falling through the chimney and getting covered with soot. I like that a lot, Alban. I do like, too, that this seems like it might be an offhand gag, but it's actually going to play a bit into the story because, you know, now they have to clean up the soot-covered tree, right. Which, you know, they get some nice icicle effect from the water freezing on the branch. But it also has another knock-on effect. Do you want to tell us about that, Alban?
Yes. The other effect is that, you know, the tree was hoisted on top of the pavilion. And no, not only is the tree covered in nice icicle, but there are 1,000 black smaller icicle that froze around the edge of the pavilion's roof. And they need to take those down with axes.
Yeah, still more grunt work. And this is where Donald starts to reference how he wants to skip town for a week to avoid the women haranguing him about
want to do.
Right. Yeah, a lot of skipping town if you're Donald Duck. Although this time he thinks it's to be proactive skipping town. We get a little side a moment here that's quite funny to me, of Scrooge trying to hector him into signing a petition to replace the cha-cha dance with a lantern slides presentation, which I've got to imagine. I think a pretty archaic name for a slideshow. And I think the point is that these are kind of out of fashion even by then, right? They were something that were kind of for older folks. But of course, Scrooge is just trying to avoid the prize, having to buy the prize. And so when he can't find a single lantern slide fan, he tosses his petition in the trash and says there's only one thing to do. What is he going to do, Alban?
Well, if he is going to buy this silver bowl, then it means he must win it himself. So he's got to learn cha-cha.
That's right. He's going to enroll in dance school. It's cute. It's definitely pretty weird to see Scrooge McDuck learning the cha-cha. It's also weird, too, that Donald has not actually yet arranged for Daisy to be his partner at this point. We're on, page 12, and he's just getting her to agree after having, done all this grunt work for her. We have this funny moment where she says, I guess I'm even that grateful, but please try to brush up on your dancing, Donald. Like, we don't see a lot of confidence in Daisy here at all.
No, that's true. And the thing is, I think the story is a bit unclear as to just how good a dancer Daisy herself is supposed to be. We haven't seen her dance before. Right. So just how better at it is she than Donald? We just don't know. We have her word, that's all.
Yes, that's true. I kind of wish we had more. Yeah, you know what? I'll say it. We only get one panel of Scrooge dancing, of him learning to dance. It is with a character named Rosita.
One-off character, yes.
Yeah, she's a one-off character. I mean, she's delightful, I think. She's certainly coded as being Cuban herself.
Sure.
And she's a female character, which is remarkable enough. There's nothing like There's nothing too special about her, but you don't get a whole lot of these kind of one-off characters.
She doesn't get that much characterization, but you kind of feel it could have evolved into something more interesting if given enough time to develop the arc better, you see, because she does seem to have a certain level of chemistry almost with Scrooge.
Yeah, I agree. Not exactly romantic, but not
romantic,
unromantic.
No. But you almost feel there should have been more coming out of this, but it just doesn't happen. No.
Right. And I will definitely reiterate, I would like to have seen at least 3 panels, I think, interspersed of him learning the cha-cha. That could have been, I think, very entertaining. But as it is, we're made to know that he's picked it up very fast with the motivation of not wanting to lose money.
I should say that as a whole, there's actually very little dancing in this story titled After Dance.
Right, exactly. There is not a ton of cha-cha-ing. Maybe it is right that the Germans went with the poetry title. I don't know. Christmas Mayhem might almost work better. So at this point, Donald and the kids are going to get home after a long day. And finally, we're going to get the reveal. Apparently, I don't know how many days have passed, Albom, but it has to be a few where this letter has just been laying on the table without Donald noticing it. It stretches the imagination a little. Although I will say, I think that Gregory and Barks here do a great job of making the reader feel the impact of this mess up, right? It feels to me, I read this as very stressful in this moment.
Yes, well, you get that feeling through mainly, I'd say, 2 details. Once the nephew realizes that they've forgotten, they take flight almost, you know. they go hide under their bed. Each one of them thinks the other had indeed posted that letter. We're in a time when Donald was still wanted to chasing his nephew with a stick. So yeah, I guess the triplets are just trying to protect their rear ends from the
right, by cowering under the bed. But Donald is just too stricken, too panicked to even care.
He thinks he'll be tarred and feathered if those many anxious women catch him.
Right. Funny idea of feathering someone who already
feathering
feathers.
A duck.
So this next panel is to me probably the most iconic, and not just because of the quick little background gag. I just really like that bit of dialogue where he says, "I'll have to skulk in dark alleys like a hunted coyote. I won't even dare show up at the cha-cha contest." Maybe I've just read that so many times because it does get highlighted by fans as being one of the only like sources of real trivia for this story. I don't know, but that bit of dialogue just stands out to me a little bit.
Well, he does have a flair for the dramatic.
Right. And again, this to me reads like something that Barks has written. I don't have that on any authority. It just feels very Carl Barks-like. What is the little bit of trivia on this panel, Albom?
Well, you've got this wanted poster, which is obviously a self-caricature of Karl Barks himself, who's wanted for being bad.
That's hilarious. The phrasing to me, that just cracks me up. Wanted for being bad. I don't know. But I find that totally delightful, and I love the caricature. Barks likes to depict himself. He likes to, like any good caricaturist, he focuses on one trait. And in his case, I think he imagines himself as being very big-nosed. His other time caricaturing himself, he kind of focused on his hay fever, his bad allergies, which is something he was always acutely aware of in his own life.
Later on, he was also poking fun at, if memory serves me right, at his being hard of hearing.
Yeah, I don't remember that specifically. That'll be interesting.
I think there must have been at least one caricature where you can see him wear a...
Oh, yeah, that sounds familiar.
Hearing aid, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. So Donald's really at his lowest here. Oh, this is another congruency, another parallel to our other Bob Gregory one, right? Where he snuck in that neat little detail about his own wife. He had given her her own department store in Christmas in Duckburg. So for whatever reason, these were the opportunities that he took to kind of entertain himself when he didn't have to think about the writing. So let's see, the Christmas festivities are going to begin and Donald is still cowering, but the guilty nephews, they manage to kind of resolve the whole situation off page, I guess. This doesn't feel very convincing to me. Albon, this is probably the part of the story that I feel the most critical about, because this is the problem, right? This is the conflict. And a resolution should feel kind of proportionate to the conflict, I feel like. It shouldn't be just kind of handled off screen in a couple panels of dialogue the way it is.
Handled off screen or not, the resolution as a whole seems a little underwhelming to me, because I'm going to describe it. They decided to sort of kill two birds with one stone because they needed to decorate the store windows and they had forgotten to send that letter. So they decide to use the Ajax poems for windows decoration. And the explanation here is that all the ladies will be happy because they're getting their greetings to more people than they could have reached by sending cards, which seems a little nonsensical to me. Do they think all their friends live in the neighborhood, in Duckburg even? What about Aunt May from Sacramento? How is she going to read those cards now?
Yeah, that's my thought. What about your friend from Goose Hollow or what have you? It's very pat. It's very convenient. It works because it only works in as much as that's what happens and that's how he's written it.
And we do see, in this case, we do see a few samples of that famous poet's work. And I must say, it's not great.
Yeah, I won't highlight them all, but I will mention the one that I always thought, even as a small child, was pretty weird. Happy wishes, happy thoughts from the Gishes and the Vaughts. Do we have two families sending one greeting? And I mean, obviously, we're giving this way more thought than it really deserves. But such is the point of a podcast like this. All right. So Donald is saved. Everyone has been mollified by this solution. And we're not going to speak about it anymore. On to the cha-cha competition. We've got a couple of funny moments here where both Donald and Scrooge are simultaneously thinking, I'm going to win that, when they talk about the silver punch bowl donated on behalf of the Billionaires Club. And then the stakes get raised because the announcer, the MC, says the billionaires have filled the bowl with 3 gallons of silver dollars. You know, I looked up how many dollars to a gallon pretty recently when I covered the Money Champ.
I was about to ask.
To be honest, I've completely forgotten, and it doesn't matter enough to me to remember. I remember it not really amounting to that much. It's only a few $100 or something.
Well, a few $100 in the 50s is about 10 times more now.
Exactly. Oh, we also have a moment where Daisy was hoping or afraid that Donald wasn't going to show up. So again, she's demonstrating a total lack of confidence. But it does go really well for Donald and Daisy. He surprises her by being a good cha-cha dancer. And then the nephews are surprised watching Uncle Scrooge dancing with his partner, Rosita, the cha-cha teacher. Do you notice what the middle nephew comments about his dancing?
He's doing real ginchy.
So I'm an American. I had never heard that term outside of this.
Really?
Did you have any idea?
Not at all.
Apparently it's slang from the 30s. That means what you think it would. You know, it's the best, it's swell. But I think this is Bob Gregory really kind of dating himself by using some archaic slang. So anyway, we have Donald and his partner Daisy being selected for the finals, along with Scrooge McDuck and his partner Rosita. And apparently Donald and Daisy haven't even noticed at this point, because this is the moment when Daisy is going to develop her nerves, having to go against this professional.
And, you know, that's where the story calls for something exciting, because here what you're expecting is a terrific dance-off between the two couples, and then none of that happens.
No, do you want to tell us what does happen? And I totally agree with you. This is, but tell us about it.
Well, the master of ceremony, I guess, tells them that in honor of the Yuletide, the dancing couples will wear a large wreath around their waist during the dance. And since Daisy has become such a wreck of nerves, the nephews decide to tell her to say something in her ear to spring her into action. And then we see Daisy doing those crazy jumps all around the place. I'm not quite sure that's how you're even supposed to dance the cha-cha. And we learn at the end that they told her there was poison oak in the wreath, which is why she was jumping all around out of fear she would get blisters, I guess. We don't have poison oak here, so I don't really know what are the risks.
So, I mean, poison oak, poison ivy are all pretty common out here, and children would be very familiar with that. It just causes some like rashiness that's quite itchy. But it's definitely pretty naive of Daisy, right? This feels pretty infantilizing of her to be suckered this easily, that like these people putting on a contest are going to do this. But again, it's just written for the sake of this being what happens. And yeah, that's how they're gonna win it, because the judges agree that her cha-cha was crazy.
So just a fun fact, since we don't have poison oak here, it was replaced by nettle in the French text.
Which you would like feel immediately.
Of course you would. But I don't think there was any other way to adapt it, really, because...
That we have another... In another of these Gregory tales, we have something that's a little bit hard to translate, although it's not because of any silly wordplay this time, as it was in that last episode.
No. And like you said, her cha-cha was crazy. Yes. It probably really is nothing like cha-cha. And right. By that logic, she shouldn't have won, should she?
No, I imagine the teacher would probably protest loudly. That is not cha-cha. But, you know, this is definitely one of those stories where things happen because they're supposed to happen.
Because they need to, yeah.
And it wraps up with a little silly rhyme that I don't think is even really worth saying out loud. Because it's a very pat wrap up, but everything has turned out just fine for Donald and his nephews. And that's it. That's the Christmas cha-cha. And I enjoy this story. I don't think it's a good story, Albon, but I definitely don't think it's like bad, right? It's not like outright bad. It's a little bit nonsensical. The stakes are not very high. It is certainly at or near the bottom of the heap as far as Bark's longer Christmas tales go. I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably his worst one. I can't think of one that is any worse than this. And I will say that I think the Christmas and Duckburg collaboration that Barks and Gregory did, I guess it's not fair to call it a collaboration if Barks just gets a script and then sits down and writes it. But anyway, Christmas and Duckburg is quite a bit better than this one.
Yes. Too. Okay. But, by comparison, certainly. Yeah.
Right. That one was actually quite enjoyable, and I think in a certain light could be mistaken as a Bark story. This one is strange enough and like convoluted enough that I think it stands out a lot more as not really a Bark story, although his art is definitely up to par for the most part.
Yeah, the art, well, the thing is with Barks, the art always saves the day. It always saves everything. Just looking at the expressions, the movements, in itself, it's a treat, and that's how I choose to read this one, to reread this one, for the pleasure of the eyes.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to go into this one, a good way to acknowledge it. Again, I really do find this an enjoyable, if very lightweight story. There's just not really a lot to say about it. It was interesting to research a little bit about the cha-cha and to learn about an archaic term. But otherwise, this is a pretty disposable story. So, you know, it sounds like we're in pretty strong agreement that it's not, certainly not Bark's best, but it's not an outright disaster. Let's check in on what the rest of the community thinks of this one. We always like to look at Index and how it's been received, since people can vote. And as of right now, it's got a 7.2 out of 10 on Index, which is good for 961 out of all nearly 43,000 stories that are rated on Index. So it just squeaks in into the top 1,000 stories. And if you break it out, as I have done, and just look at Bark's adventure length stories, this one clocks in at number 112 out of his like approximately 120 adventure length stories. So we're in the 93rd percentile. So obviously people don't think very highly of this one relative to Bark's other stories. It does clock in above just a couple of stories that Bark's of Bark's written and drawn stories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it does have that going for it. That's pretty good. People think it was better than Forbidium Money Bin and Queen of the Wild Dog Pack. Oh, and
I must say, I haven't read it often. It hasn't aged well.
Right. Yeah, it's been a while for me, but I remember not being very, very kindly disposed towards it. It does rank above the one that I really ripped on recently, Jungle Hijinks, but it's only a little ways above it. Like, that one is at approximately 1,086 when I captured this. And I'll say, I think this story is dramatically better than that one. I dragged that one because its storytelling was nonsensical. This one had some like convoluted storytelling, but it's not nonsensical. Like, I was able to follow the story. I definitely think it was a little overwrought and a little bit overstuffed. Let's see. I don't think there's too much more to say. There's, you know, not really a lot of follow-up with this one, as you would not expect. So, Alban, I'll just ask if you have any final thoughts on this one that you didn't get to mention, or if you'd like to point out a panel that was a favorite of yours that you think deserves to be highlighted.
I don't think I have much more to say about it, but if I had to choose certain panels, well, one of them would definitely be something you pointed out yourself, the sleeping lady signing for an order. That's very funny to me, and it brings back many memories of harsh mornings. So I guess I might have bought those cards at some point.
Sure. Yeah, I think all of the character poses that Donald has during the salesman are actually really delightful. There are some really nice moments in that sequence. And then I do like the panel where he is come through the community center chimney and emerge from the fireplace all covered in soot and says, "Believe it or not, ladies, it isn't Santa Claus." That was pretty fun. I also liked, you know, the moment of discovery of the unsent letter. That really did feel pretty stressful and visceral. And then as he's just leaving for the dawn again in that sales moment, I really liked that. That line about, I guess most folks are still pretty relaxed at 6:30 a.m. that actually made me laugh. It is kind of refreshing, I think. We alluded a bit to this, that Donald is actually very good for the most part at what he's doing in this one, and it's kind of refreshing to see. But it's not in one of those over-the-top ways where he's really good at it and then things just go horribly wrong. I mean, they do, but it's not because of some mistake he makes with the job itself.
And he's not only very good, he's also quite a lot more reasonable than he usually is. Take, for example, when he tries to sell his pitch to a Mr. Grouch, and basically winds up, he gets thrown out and falling with his bum in the snow. And in other conditions, the same Donald might have gotten very angry and plotted some kind of revenge, but it's just not the case here. He says, well, I can't win him all, I guess.
Right.
So
yeah,
we're not used to seeing him in like that, which once again might be a Bob Gregory thing.
It might. It also might mean that this version of Donald is a little bit boring, right? Like it's the mayhem around the story is definitely not like around Donald. So that might be something to be critical of.
You could almost imagine it as a Mickey Mouse story.
Yeah, I think that's the case with a lot of these that have been written by someone else, that there's not a ton of reason. I mean, they name drop Junior Woodchucks and everything, but it could have been any generic Cubs.
They could have been Morty and Ferdy.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's true. That's a good point. That's probably a good point to leave off, because I think we covered this very lightweight story more than anyone else is ever going to do. That's for sure.
Agreed.
So again, Alban, thank you so much for joining. People can check out, you know, you are these days, of course, we mentioned editing the Journal de Mickey and the Picsou comics, and you're involved. People can check you out. I think Picsou Soir has a Facebook presence, probably on Instagram as well.
Yes, we do have a presence on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and of course, there's the website.
Excellent. So yeah, check out Picsou Soir and check out Bark's Remarks on many of the same social media platforms.
Do check out Picsou Soir if you can read French, and if you can't read French, well, check it out all the same.
That's right. Just go ahead and learn. Oh, people can always get in touch. I mentioned occasionally we're barksremarks@gmail.com. And check in on our next episode when we get to talk about the great Carl Barks sci-fi adventure, Island in the Sky. Thanks again, Alban.
Thank you again, Mark. It's always a pleasure to be here. Let's make it a habit.
Absolutely. It's a delight. And I look forward to having you back.